This Week in Retronauts, Octum, baby. Everyone, welcome to an episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am here at Tokyo Game Show 2019 in Chiba, Japan. And naturally, because I'm in Japan, I'm talking to a German colleague, obviously, of course. German colleague, introduce yourself.
Hello, everybody. My name is Thomas Nickel. I am a journalist, and I'm a game lecturer from Germany, and I'm happy to be here on Retronauts.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. We've been... You know, we've corresponded for years, and you do great work, and I know you're a fan of Retronauts, so it's awesome to have you on the show, but even if it seems a little strange to be in Japan talking to someone from Europe instead of someone from Japan, this is just kind of, you know, like a place where people with common interests come together to look at classic games, and this year's TGS, I haven't been here in like 4 years, and it was getting kind of bleak for a while. It was all like social games and mobile games and lots of like Chinese companies were buying out Japanese publishers and putting up these big empty booths, and it was like what's happening. But this year there's a lot of good stuff on the show floor. There's, and you know, relevant to our interests.
I like it. I really had fun yesterday walking across the show floor.
Yeah, relevant to our interests, there are a lot of classic IPs being brought back, a lot of love for, you know, old franchises, a lot of new stuff too, lots of indies. But I mean, Konami's booth had a pretty decent mobile Castlevania game that's very much in the
decent,
style.
Seriously?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty playable.
Okay, I have a look today.
It's basically Harmony of Despair, you know.
But, I like that one.
But done up for a mobile game with more of like a mission structure, and I'm sure there are lots of hooks for gacha and microtransactions. But you know, from what little I played, it was pretty decent, and it's, you know, they got new Ayami Kojima art, so at least they're putting a little thought and effort into it. But Contra's back, the PC Engine Mini. Did you have a chance to play that?
I saw it at Gamescom, but I couldn't play it. I only saw the hardware.
Okay. Well, they have playable demo units here.
That's awesome.
Nice. They've got a whole bunch set up, so you'll have to definitely jump in line and try that out, because it's really good.
Okay.
Like, the amount of love they put into it is crazy. It's just so good. Like, every time you start up a game, on screen you see a like a Who card slide up into the system. Or if you start up a CD game, then you see, like, the System 3 card slide up. And then
that
it shows a disc spinning up.
And
when you switch systems from like PC Engine to Turbo Graphics, you get like a static screen, and it kind of goes to pinpoint, like you're turning off a TV and then switching over the system.
So you'd say
there's even a game Turbo Express frame with a screen filter that looks just like the PC or the Turbo Express frame or PC Engine GT if you're doing the Japanese region stuff. It's awful, but I love that they did it. It's just like, oh, they put so much love into this.
I'm just really glad I pre-ordered it in France, because as the original one, it didn't come out in Germany.
Did the TurboGrafx or PC Engine even make it to Europe at all?
There are rumors that it made it somehow to certain regions, but it was never really released in Germany, I'm sure of that.
Yeah, it was...
But it was a big import thing back in the day.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually what I want to talk to you about today, is just to like get a sense of what it was like growing up playing video games, what the retro gaming scene is now, and what gaming was like growing up in Germany. Because, you know, Retronauts is obviously, being an American podcast, produced from, you know, framed in an American perspective. And I think most of us on the show are big fans of Japanese games. So we have a pretty strong understanding just through research and secondhand experience about how things were in Japan. But Europe is fuzzier to us, and especially continental Europe, because most information about classic gaming that makes it to the US from Europe is from the UK, you know, since it's English language.
Yeah.
It's a natural fit for us. But the UK perspective on gaming is very different, I know, from continental Europe. But, you know, we don't get a lot of information in German or France or Spanish in the US. So it's all kind of like a big fuzzy blur for us. So that's what I'd love to hear from you is
yeah,
just
let's
like,
try and change that.
Like all we know is that you guys had to have robots in Contra. That's it.
Oh, I love the robots.
No, the robots are fun, but, you know, like that is kind of the... Like, when people talk about classic games in Germany and America, like, I think that's what they tend to think about is like, oh, there's censorship. But, you know,
there's so much more
to that.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to talk to you about.
Maybe just to start with the censorship thing, that's maybe just one thing we could just notice. The thing is, Germany, of course, we are really strict in terms of violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like the USA is rather strict in terms of nudity. Germany is quite relaxed in that regard. Dead or Alive Extreme was released with for 12-year-olds. Violence is a big problem, and for many years games were censored, and usually they swapped out the human characters for robots, as in Contra, which became Pro Protector in Germany, and by that also the rest of Europe, of course. Mm-hmm. Also Command & Conquer, for example. They just took the same game, they removed the bloodstains when you shoot a soldier, and they changed the voiceovers to robot voiceovers. Things like I'm losing oil and that stuff. It was hilarious. Of course, we all knew what was happening, but yeah, that was just what it was like. I mean, yeah, we have some state agencies about, not censorship, but about regulation of these things, but they have become a lot more relaxed in the recent years. Things like God of War or things like other recent real violent games. Mortal Kombat 11 just came out uncensored and... free to buy for everybody. So this has definitely changed.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, America still hasn't become more lax about nudity in games. So, you know, I guess liberalism only happens in some directions. But yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Germany's because it's such a significant country, it has such a large population, it exerted a lot of influence over gaming throughout Europe. And so a lot of things that were made, like changes that were made to games for Germany or decisions made to fit the German market, just kind of were, you know, they trickled into the rest of Europe.
Yeah. But I'm afraid we didn't have a good influence for the most part, because we gave Europe all the censorship, but we didn't give many good games back, on the other hand. So if you're looking for European developed games, you look, for example, in France, they happened a lot. You look at the UK. Even Spain often had more, but Germany... I think the Germans are rather conservative in these things. Playing is a childish thing, and nobody wants to fund a company making play stuff. And even today, German game developers don't have it easy, because at the moment there's a huge debate about sponsorship by the state, like, for example, like Canada does. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a difficult thing. And of course, also German gaming tastes, at least... games only meant for the German market are also German-specific. So a huge thing, for example, is the farming simulator. Mm-hmm. One of the hugest things in the German-speaking area. But, of course, I think pointless for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a few other European countries that really like the farming simulator games. But, yeah, it definitely isn't something that ever really caught on in the U.S. And I know when those first started showing up in the U.S. market, we were all like, is this really a thing?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I know. It's a
it's so German.
Thing.
It's a working simulator.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. Yeah, but, you know, just kind of going back to your own personal experiences.
Yeah.
As a kid, you know, what kind of systems did you play? What kind of games did you like? And were those typical of your peers, your fellow students?
Well, just to start with that, I think the first things I played on was the Commodore 64 at a friend's house. This was back then the big thing in Germany. Mm-hmm. I think the Commodore 64 is the same thing that the Famicom is for Japan and the NES is for America, for the USA. And this was pretty much a system everybody had, because it was easy to explain to your parents, yeah, I need this computer to work for school. Of course, nobody ever did. Everybody had this huge rack of pirated games. And these this is where I made my first experiences. I played, for example, things like Caveman Olympics at a friend, which is a bit of like track and field, but with Caveman. It was hilarious. I played things like G.I. Joe. I liked really that multiplayer aspect. But it didn't really hook me. Later on, at a cousin's house, I played games on the Amiga, which was also a big thing in Germany. And I think this is where my taste started to develop, because the game I really loved was Bubble Bobble.
Okay.
That was a really great part, and I can't say what it was that hooked me, but it's just this game, I really loved that game.
Yeah, that's not really a game I think of when I think of the Amiga. You think of things like Shadow of the Beast or like really the graphical showcase games that you saw from like Psygnosis and that sort of thing.
But I think it's also
Bible is kind of simplistic looking.
Yeah, but I was young at that time, so I think that was just good to get insight. I think Shadow of the Beast would have just overwhelmed me with its difficulty and the freedom and everything. So, but yeah, of course these were the big things. Shadow of the Beast, and of course a big thing was also Turrican. I think Turrican.
Turrican. Yeah, sure.
I mean, this is a German series, and pretty much this is a typical thing for the day. Turrican just takes elements from Metroid, from Mario, and from Contra, and just puts them in the blender and makes a new game out of them. So it's not original, but it was really well crafted and really well made because these German guys, a guy called Manfred Trenz, with long hair and a mustache back in the 80s, was a great programmer. And then the guy from Factor 5, you might know them from Star Wars games later on, Rogue Squadron and so on, put it on Amiga and really they made the game sing. So this was the showcase. And I think this was also pretty much console quality gaming at this in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the Turrican games made their way to the consoles, Super Turrican, Mega Turrican, etc. But I know that those did start on computers, and they never really were big in the U.S. But
no, because no Amiga in the U.S., or no big Amiga.
But there's still kind of that legacy to it. So, you know, when Analog released the Super NT, they put a like the director's cut of Super Turrican on there. So, you know, it definitely does have a little bit of mind share, but yeah, it's, I know that it was definitely big in Europe, and I can see where that would be.
And generally, the second game on the Amiga is considered the high point of the series. This is where everything came together. They had these shooter levels in the middle, for example, with great music. It looked awesome, and this was really the one that really everything fell in place. The ones afterwards were good, but you could see that in Super Turrican, for example, they had to do with a lower memory, and Mega Turrican was very different in terms of speed, in terms of pacing, so Turrican 2 is a big thing. And of course, what's sad about it, this game was ported to consoles as Universal Soldier, and it was hideous.
I didn't realize that was where Universal Soldier came
from. It's pretty much, it's a ROM hack of Turrican 2 with many of the good elements just removed and looking a lot worse.
Okay, that seems to kind of miss the point, but...
Absolutely.
So you played a lot of C64, you played a lot of Amiga. Were consoles...
Not a lot. I played it at friends.
Oh, you played some. Okay.
Yeah. But consoles were where I really found my gaming home in a way. So the thing is, a friend of mine had an NES, which I found interesting, but then the Game Boy did it. I think generally also the Game Boy was the big breakthrough for console gaming, for that sort of gaming in Europe, because Nintendo didn't put too much effort into the NES before. Sega was somehow present, but also not too big, but the Game Boy really hit it big in Germany.
Yeah, I know Nintendo had kind of a poor reputation for not optimizing their games for PAL. From NTSC.
They all had borders on the upper and lower part of the screen, and they ran about 17% slower than the than they should have.
And that affected the audio, too. It was, like, all out of tune, right?
Yeah, it was slower. If you compare Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers, America and Europe, it was just this slow-paced underwater version.
Yeah, and... you know, I also have been doing a lot of chronicling the NES. So when I'm putting together lists of release dates, like the European release date sometimes is 3 years behind
it was
American
weird.
Release, which was already a year behind the Japanese release. So
we got that stuff really, really late often.
Yeah, I mean, you had like the Mega Drive by the time that some of these, you know, kind of early NES games in America were coming out in Europe.
Yeah.
It's just a missed opportunity. But Game Boy, yeah, like I feel one of the great things that people tend to overlook about handheld systems is they're sort of, you know, back in the days of analog displays, they were independent of display standards. Like sometimes I see people refer to European releases of Game Boy games as PAL, and I'm like,
That's technically absolutely incorrect.
It was just the same hardware. Yeah. Like, you know, you didn't have to worry about the kind of electricity that was, you know, 240
versus
120.
You just put in four batteries and that's it.
You put batteries in. You didn't have to worry about the screen refresh rate because it was always the same.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, and there wasn't even a region lockout.
No, it was compatible. The NES was region locked, for example, so we couldn't even import games from America. There were ways to modify it, but even if you did that, you had a problem getting them to run on your TV in color at this point. And, of course, the Game Boy, I remember back in the day, I walked into one of the big stores, the Media Markt, which is pretty much like... what's the American chain?
Like Walmart or?
No, not Walmart. Only Best for Buy? Media. It's Best Buy, right? Okay. It's Best Buy in America, in Germany. And just suddenly I saw Japanese games in the Game Boy display. Things like Nintendo World Cup, for example. So suddenly, okay, there's Japanese games now. Interesting.
Was Game Boy big among your friends, or was it just something that you were into personally?
No, it was really a thing about, with my friends. Mm-hmm. Usual thing, one guy bought a Game Boy. We also had Tetris for Super Mario Land, and so we all had to have one. Mm-hmm. So we were, of course, a bit skeptical. It's in black and white, and I mean, I played on the Amiga before, but just Mario really looks nice, so I got one maybe a few months later, and yeah, I was pretty much hooked. Mm-hmm. Games like, as I said, Mario and Tetris, and later on, Burai Fighter or Gargoyle's Quest. This was really stuff that shaped my taste until today.
Mm. Okay. So, you know, it kind of was a different route than the hosts of Retronauts took, but it seems like we all kind of ended up in the same place ultimately.
Somehow, yes.
Yeah. So what was it about these games that you found so enticing?
I think on the one hand, it's the accessibility is one important thing, because on the Amiga, for example, you have these joysticks, you have the keyboard, but they're all still, there is more of a wall between the player and the game, because they don't feel as responsive usually. For example, Interrogant is a nice game, but you jump with pressing the joystick up, and that just doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And these things, you just could just see this is another different level of polish to them. And of course, it was weird, it was exotic, it was something new, and we never saw something like that before.
So I know 16-bit consoles were more successful in Europe than they were than the 8-bit consoles were. Would you say Game Boy helped kind of pave the way for that?
It certainly did for me anyway, because when I got the Game Boy, I started reading magazines. I read about the Mega Drive, and this looked all pretty interesting. I mean, it was a wild country. There's no Mario. There is no Castlevania. Mm-hmm. But the Sonic looked interesting, so I just decided to wish for a Mega Drive on Christmas. Just jump into the cold water and get this thing, and suddenly, turning it on for the first time, seeing Sonic for the first time, this was, again, mind-blown. It was mind-blowing experience, and this is where I started seriously getting into games. And I think many people felt like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also know many went from the Amiga to the Mega Drive, because it was quite similar. They have a similar architecture. They both have the 68000 chip inside, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this was a logical step. And, of course, the Super Nintendo was coming out much later. It wasn't out until 1992, I think.
Okay, yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, like late 92 or mid to late.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So Sega definitely had
and
the
it was
jump.
Expensive.
Was it?
The games were really expensive. Back then it was 140 Deutsche Mark.
Wow. So what is that equivalent to in, you know, the exchange rate to dollars, do you know?
It should be something among, like, I think similar to, again, like Chrono Trigger in the US.
Okay. So like $90?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was really expensive. And Mega Drive was a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me?
Like for every game, was that expensive?
Nintendo was a bit better themselves, their own games. Mm-hmm. But Konami, for example, Castlevania 4 and things like that, you had really had to pay for them.
Hmm. Okay. I know that Europe did get some like kind of highly coveted, unique versions of Super Famicom games, Super NES games, with the RPGs and the big
covers, yeah. That's an interesting thing, because we didn't get any RPGs before on Nintendo systems. There was no Dragon Quest, Dragon Warrior, there was no Final Fantasy. We got Zelda, but we didn't get any turn-based RPGs. So these were the first tries by Nintendo to get them to a market. And the big boxes are because they put in a huge hint book in with every one of them, so people could really get through them with these games.
So that's actually really similar to the initiative they took in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
on NES, where they brought over Dragon Quest as Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy, Fazanadu they brought over. And all these games they packed in with huge manuals.
Oh, okay.
They weren't big boxes, but like the manuals were super thick. And, mm-hmm. you know, basically two-thirds of them were just walkthroughs for the first 10 hours of the game or so to say,
okay.
like, here's how you play this. So Nintendo did bring over a couple of RPGs.
It was,
in
for example,
boxes.
It was Mystic Quest, where they just, removed the name Final Fantasy. It wasn't on there.
Mm-hmm.
Only Mystic Quest, they brought, Secret of Mana was the next one afterward. And then this was a big one in Germany. Many people still have, memories, and this is one of the big nostalgia titles in Germany.
Secret of Mana?
Yeah.
Hmm.
This is a really big thing. They also brought later on Illusion of Gaia as mm-hmm. the Illusion of Time. Mm-hmm. And
I remember seeing that when I was somewhere in Europe. It was either Prague or maybe it was Berlin. Like 1996, and I saw Illusion of Time and thought, wow, is that a sequel to Illusion of Gaia? And then I looked more closely, I was like, oh, that is Illusion of Gaia.
No idea whether they changed the name, but they did anyway. And of course, the big one we got in the end was Terranigma, which America mm-hmm. didn't get. Mm-hmm. This was, of course, really late. The PlayStation was out already, and my friends were playing Legacy of Kain. Still, I got me Terranigma, and I loved every minute of it.
So you said turn-based RPGs hadn't come over on consoles. Were there computer RPGs at that point?
These were big, yeah. We had the SSI games. Mm-hmm. We had German productions like called Das Schwarze Auge. I think they came to America as well. It's a big German pen and paper role-playing games, role-playing system. They were rather dry, but the pen and paper fans loved them because they put in every rule of the pen and paper game.
Okay.
So we had some of these, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it just hadn't made the jump to consoles.
Exactly,
Nintendo pushed it. What kind of games were big on Mega Drive over there?
On Mega Drive, we had, of course, Sonic was a big thing. The sports games were big. And I personally got into importing quite early with the Mega Drive because it was easy to do. You just need an adapter. Mm-hmm. So the cartridge fits. And the funny thing is back then, imports were cheaper than officially released games. Mm-hmm. So I remember, for example, I got Quackshot, the Donald Duck game, mm-hmm. with the Indiana Jones hat, and I paid, I think, about a quarter less than I would have paid for the German version a few months later.
Were there compatibility issues in terms of PAL and TSC with Mega Drive games through the adapter?
Well, this is where it gets interesting, because there were, of course, the games were slower, the sound was slower. But we found out pretty fast that you could mod your consoles, so you could get this nice 60 hertz speed out of it. And this is what many people did then. They modded their SNES, they modded their Mega Drives. It cost about maybe a little less than buying one game, and suddenly you had a switch on the system. You could just say, let's go up to 60 hertz, and it was all running in original speed.
Huh, okay.
And, of course, also nice, Germany and Europe is, of course, we have RGB. Mm-hmm. Even in the 80s, and mm-hmm. So we had the speed and we had the great picture quality.
Right, so you basically had the best of every possible world.
If we were willing to jump to them hoops.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, I think that was kind of the era where people started to look at their games more critically and say, you know, how can I get the best experience out of this? You know, in America, it was buying an S-video adapter or, you know, getting like a console adapter to play Japanese games. So, yeah.
And once you see the difference, of course, between RGB and a SCART cable and a AV cable, or you see the difference between 50 and 60 hertz, you can't go back anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This is why, for example, the N64 never clicked with me because I couldn't switch up to 60 hertz. I didn't have any RGB quality. It was just a blurry mess, and that was the N64 for me.
Yeah. I mean, the N64 kind of was a blurry mess because of some of the internal limitations of the system, but it's interesting that you couldn't do the switch, I guess because of 3D, it would like...
I think it was just a much more complex hardware at this point.
Okay.
For example, also about importing on the PlayStation, of course, you also couldn't do a switch there. But if you bought a PlayStation game in the US or Japan, it would run in 60 hertz on the German system if you had modded it.
Mm-hmm. Which is makes it extra strange that when they put together the PlayStation Mini, let's put the 50 hertz versions out in all regions.
That was a bad thing.
It was a weird choice.
Yeah.
Fuzzy on is, you know, the PAL standard, the system, like the television, refreshes at 50 hertz. So if you're running the game at 60 hertz and the TV is refreshing at 50, that doesn't cause any problems, any incompatibilities?
No, it didn't, because usually TVs could just display 60 hertz as well. The only thing that's important is you have to get the picture in with the RGB cord.
Mm-hmm.
Because RGB doesn't seem to care about that, so the TV just goes to 60 hertz, and that's it.
Okay. Interesting. So kind of the, you know, the just the nature and logistics of console gaming and at the time sort of created this savvy audience, I guess. Yeah. You could say.
And if you, I think many people, especially in Germany, they like just to fiddle around with the hardware, because Germany also was, of course, a big PC country, because people like to open up their kits and put in new stuff to improve their thing. And yeah, they did the same with consoles. So it fell on a fertile ground.
Right. So, you know, kind of jumping ahead to the present day, what's the retro gaming scene like in Germany? Like, what is, you know, what are people into, I guess? You know, in America, I think you have different kind of communities of retro gamers, PC and console. You have the Sega versus Nintendo camps. I'm curious if it's divided up sort of like that in Germany, or if it's, you know, just... if it breaks up differently?
It used to be divided, of course. Sega vs. Nintendo was a big thing in the 90s. But nowadays, it's rather relaxed. It's more maybe a bit of a computer versus console thing. Mm-hmm. Because a huge group of retro enthusiasts are much into home computers. We have a huge homebrew scene for the C64, for example. We have museums in Berlin, for example, which show original hardware and games and rare artifacts. And on the other hand, the next generation would be the Nintendo guys, Nintendo kid back in the day. And they are, of course, all into collecting for Super Nintendo. Little bit NES, but Super Nintendo is still the big nostalgia factor. Mm-hmm. At the moment, there is we have many retro fairs in Germany. Pretty much every 2 or 3 weeks, there is one in another city where we have traders offering their goods. And you can usually see that Nintendo stuff goes for a lot more than, for example, Sega stuff.
That's the case here in the U.S. also, and I don't know what it is about. I don't think it's anything to do with the systems themselves or the games. I think it's just the audience. Like, the Nintendo fans tend to be more, I don't know, covetous, more determined to create, you know, complete sets and that sort of thing. So,
and of course, there's a thing about the
Mega Drive Genesis games that are like super expensive, like Hagane or something. Mm. But for the most part, it's
SNES games like Hagane.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Mugia Aleste is the Genesis one.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Glaylancer, of course. Mm-hmm. Holy Grail, in a way.
Right. But, I mean, those are kind of few and far between compared to the Super NES games. Like, you go to a retro gaming convention, and it's, you know, there's dozens of games that command hundreds of dollars.
I mean, this is also kind of a Nintendo tax, simply because the traders know people want them, so they just make them 10 or 20 euros more expensive. And of course, if you have a box and an instruction manual, it goes even higher up, because these things often were thrown away back in the day. And of course, Sega games, usually you get them complete with everything.
Right, because of the plastic clamshell, was... I think you were more likely, more inclined to keep something that was made of plastic. It just seemed more...
Yeah, but just the game would just fit in. It could put it in your cupboard or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what I've personally found is that handheld games are almost impossible. Like, there's some games that are just impossible to find the packaging for, because those were smaller, and, you know, who wants to keep all this stuff around when you've got such a tiny cartridge?
And I think, like the US, these things were later considered kiddie games, and of course, the kids get a game, remove the cartridge, and just throw the packaging away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The bane of the retro collector.
Yeah.
But would you say it's a pretty vibrant scene over there?
Absolutely. I mean, we have these fairs. We have two, three or four various retro magazines. Many of the print magazines have their retro experts and retro articles. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's quite present.
Yeah, actually, do you want to talk about the magazine that you write for?
Sure.
It's not one that is very, I would say, very well known in the U.S., but it's a great magazine, really high quality.
Thank you.
Very, very dense. Every issue is like, it looks like this one's about 100 pages, and it's just a ton of content.
Yeah, it's called M Games, and it's around since 1994. It's the only one that survived from these days, because I think, maybe much like the US, we had a big magazine purge in the early 2000s, another one a few years later. And this is one of the survivors, and I think one of the reasons is we try to put in every game there is. We don't just concentrate on a few AAA titles, and we try to put in more stuff apart from reviews and previews and these things, so more feature articles and things like that. That's what we try to do. And of course, also a thing is we try not to be too expensive when producing that thing. It's a small team doing that. It's a dedicated team, and... of course, it's not a big thing anymore. We used to sell much, much more in the early 2000s, but everybody did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people just don't buy print as much, and that's why there's basically there are no gaming magazines outside of Game Informer in the U.S. anymore.
I remember back about my gaming. I imported Game Fan magazine from the U.S.
Back
through relatives.
Yeah, back in the late 90s, there were probably a dozen games magazines.
Yeah, especially Game Fan was for me sort of a holy Bible because you could just feel that enthusiasm seeping through the pages. And of course, these guys were really, really into it and sometimes maybe a bit too much. I mean, I remember I bought Tale of the Sun because I loved it so much and... Okay, it's interesting, but I'm not sure what they were going for.
Yeah, I mean, I did really admire the fact that GameFan would stand up for these games that, like, you know, only they're super niche, super super esoteric, but they still really seem to believe in them, and that's great.
I remember last time I was here in Japan, I saw a copy of Hermie Hoppard for the PlayStation, and just GameFan came into my mind, okay, I have to buy this, it's not expensive, let's get this.
But I mean, I'm looking at, you know, M here, M Magazine, or M Games, and...
It used to be called Maniac before, but we had to change the name. No, we didn't have to. We want to change the name because people didn't know where to place it in the stores.
Okay. But I mean, you've got Bloodstained on the cover. That's not, you know, a huge AAA game, so that really does kind of...
Yeah, but it's one that interests...
...to your ethos there.
It interests our readers, but of course, this is the cover for subscribers. We have a normal cover for the newsstands.
Ah, okay. So what was the cover equivalent for the newsstand?
Open it. You can see it on the first page. It's just a bit of a collage. I think Control is the big thing on the cover.
Okay. So that's not a huge game, but definitely much more mainstream.
Yeah.
And... I don't know, that's actually, I've heard a lot of good things about that. It's one I want to check out. It's
kind of like
artsy for the AAA space, so that's cool.
But. I'm still fighting to get Golden Axe on the cover sometimes, but so far I didn't have any luck. There's that wonderful old cover with the barbarian and the dragon in the background from the Mega Drive. We have it in high quality, but so far we couldn't agree to do that.
Was that like a Boris Vallejo cover?
It looked like it, but I don't think it... It might have been. I'm not sure now.
I know he did some Sega art. He did like
it's the Japanese cover.
Okay,
with his old barbarian with the 80s hair and everything.
Yeah, of course, a glorious mane.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, when you're over here in Japan, like what kind of stuff do you look for? I'm assuming you know just the kind of stuff that you enjoyed as a kid and the things you missed out on.
Well, the thing is, the last time I was here, I looked out for many Virtual Boy things. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, of course, it was also your Virtual Boy work that inspired me to look out a bit more for that. And on the other hand, I'm doing a bit of development myself and with a few colleagues. And we were thinking about doing something for Virtual Boy. It's still in the back of our heads, but pushed to the back at the moment. And I just got a lot of games for research purposes. Mm-hmm. And usually when I look for games, I like to buy Mega Drive stuff because I love the Japanese covers. I love the cartridges and I'm trying to get a bit of a collection on that, but I'm not a huge collector in the end. I gathered a lot of stuff over the years, but most of them just job related. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Mega Drive is a thing, I guess.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. Like I am always on the hunt for complete in box Game Boy or Super NES or whatever games, but it really is just to document them and put together videos and books. Mm. And for the most part, I don't keep stuff. My actual collection is like a few things that are very important to me personally.
Yeah. What I bought actually is I bought some Switch games, shooter collections and things like that. I bought the Zip Psycho collections, for example.
Okay.
I bought...
Is that coming out in Europe? I know it's coming
next year, but I didn't want to wait, and the price would be the same anyway. Mm-hmm. And I visited M2 a couple of days ago, and this really got me back into this whole shooter business, and I'm really looking forward to playing these.
I think that's pretty much all the time we have.
Okay.
That's also, you know, I just kind of wanted to get a kind of a, you know, from the perspective of someone who is there, a better sense of what it was like growing up playing video games in Germany.
Maybe I can give one more interesting info because in Germany, before Nintendo made these big box games, which were rather late in the lifetime of the Super Nintendo, the Mega Drive was the console for RPGs because there were none on the NES, there were none on the SNES. Mega Drive, we had Shining Force, we had Phantasy Star 2 and 3, we had Shining the Darkness, and back then, the Mega Drive was where you went if you want to play RPGs on console, so I think that's quite a weird thing for an American audience.
Yeah, I mean, definitely all those games did come to the US, but the NES and Super NES were, you know, Nintendo really pushed those franchises harder. Nintendo Power Magazine.
I was really envious.
Yeah. So you know, it wasn't that we didn't have the Sega games. It was just that they didn't have as much visibility.
You had more alternatives to them. You weren't stuck on grinding through Phantasy Star 2. I mean, I love that game, but it's such a grind.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's always great to get these kind of alternate perspectives and a better sense of how things were. And it sounds like, in a lot of ways, you know, the kind of the German retro gaming experience was more similar to the American retro gaming experience than the UK retro experience was.
I think so, too.
Like, that was, you know, that was kind of its own little Galapagos of video gaming.
Yeah. In Germany, we were really import-friendly. That's one important thing, I guess. We had many, many small stores selling import games from Japan, from America. So I just could go into the store and get Final Fantasy VII US version before the German one, where the botched translation came out. I could just go into a store and buy Musha Aleste, the Japanese version, for what would be today maybe 30 euros or $30. These were really great times for importing. And this is, I think, what also shaped the taste of many German gamers even today.
Okay, awesome. So just to wrap, where can people find you online and follow your work?
Well, if you want to find me online, you look at maniac.de, which is the website of MGames. You could look at Twitter at Bimbo Fortuna, which also has a story behind it, but that's too much to get behind now. And if you're interested, I'm making a game myself now on the Game Boy, which is called Korea and the Sunken City. And if you want to check that out, go to Twitter at Korea Game Boy. It's Coria Game Boy.
Okay. Awesome. And of course.
And of course, by the way, if you want to see me in person, go to a university at Dieburg, where I hold lectures in game design and game history.
Okay. So you're a lecturer?
Yeah.
Awesome. I did not know that about you. That's great.
I would have mentioned that.
All right. So, yeah, and of course you can find Retronauts at retronauts.com on iTunes and other services and that sort of thing. You can find and support us on Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. Get episodes early and in a higher bitrate quality than on the public feeds. It's great, and we appreciate it. And for myself, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. And around the internet, I'm there. You'll find me. Just look for me. Anyway, Thomas, thanks so much for coming in and sharing some knowledge. And yeah, I hope to catch you around while I'm shopping out in Akihabara or Nakano or whatever.
Maybe I might be there on Sunday.
Okay, I might see you.